I've been looking forward to it. I think last year I had to cancel at the last minute, if I remember correctly, and couldn't come. So I look forward to this every year, and very happy to be here tonight. I'm going to beg your indulgence a bit. I'm going to use some notes tonight. And the reason for that is that the chemo fog that I have up here makes it hard to get my thought, keep my thoughts together, organize my thoughts, and remember things. So we'll see, but this will help, I think, make it more understandable for you and for me. That my cell phone going off in the middle of the sitting was an example of that kind of fog. I apologize for that. So tonight, I thought it might be interesting to talk about a little bit about one of the seven factors of enlightenment that we don't talk about so much. And that's the factor of investigation. That's the English equivalent. The factor of investigation. Investigation is a good word, although I think I'm not going to use that. I'm going to use the word inquiry instead. There are a lot of mental factors. The Theravada monks spent centuries identifying them over and over again until they arrived at a list of about 52. But there are seven that are particularly important because without these, the mind doesn't open. And one of those seven is this factor of investigation or inquiry. Each of these has to be present for the mind to open. It's not enough to just sit back passively and observe. Sometimes our practice can get kind of passive. We have to be curious. There's got to be a real desire to know. And we have to be honest with ourselves about that desire to know. It's not a zero-sum entity. It's really more how much do we want to know. Sometimes it'll be a little, sometimes it'll be a lot, and sometimes not at all. But at the base of practice has to be this desire to want to know. Now, in talking about inquiry, I'm going to talk about our practice in some ways a little bit differently than maybe you're used to hearing about it. My practice, as yours, has been for many, many years, it's been the practice of mindfulness. But as I've gotten older and maybe, I know I've not seen things so clearly, my practice has evolved in a somewhat different direction, although to me it's still a practice of mindfulness. And I want to share a little bit of that. But if it's confusing to you or raises some questions, see if there's still something you can use. And take hold of that. And the rest just leave behind. If you have questions, of course, I'd welcome them after the talk. So maybe we can begin by going back to basics. There's a story in one of the sutras about the Buddha walking through the forest with his monks, and he stops and he reaches down and he takes up some leaves in his hand. You know the story? Yeah. And he says to the monks, the knowledge that I gained in my enlightenment is like all of these leaves in the forest. But what I teach is only these two leaves in my hand. Pretty extraordinary when you think about it. And the two leaves were suffering and the end of suffering. So that's the one thing I teach and one thing only. And that's the point and purpose of our practice. So meditation can be used for many different reasons. We practice it for maybe different reasons at different times. To calm and focus our mind, or to decrease anxiety, sometimes to uncover repressed material, and sometimes just to feel better. But the deeper underlying intention is to awaken. So none of us are immune from suffering. That's why the Buddha made it the basis of his teaching, one reason. And what is its root cause? Root cause is really very simple. We see this as all we have to do is reflect or watch our minds for a few minutes. It's that grasping, that includes the pushing away as well as the pulling toward. And especially grasping at the me. There's a Pali term for that called atava dupadana, which means that grasping at self, that grasping at me. So whatever will decrease the grasping is our practice. Yes? It actually doesn't have to be meditation. It could be anything that decreases the grasping. You might walk through your next week and look at all the different things that you do in the course of a day, and with a view toward seeing which ones promote the grasping and which ones tend to stop it. What activities promote it and what activities stop it. And whatever activities stop it, that's our practice. So in meditation practice, we start right here by not grasping at whatever draws our attention. That's where we start. In a way, we start at the end. Or put differently, by allowing ourselves to experience everything just as it is. I like that idea better. Not how we want them to be. And notice that this is an active engagement with our experience. It's not just watching the flowers grow or watching the parade of thoughts through the mind. It's a simple notion, right? Letting everything be as it is. But if we try and practice it, we all know how extremely difficult it is. Probably the single most difficult thing we could possibly try and do. Because most of the time we're trying to control and manipulate our experience to make it come out the way we want. Mostly in the service of feeling better. But awakening is not about feeling better. And even mindfulness can be used as a mechanism of control and manipulation. Trying to get somewhere with it. Trying to achieve or attain something. Perhaps what we imagine a meditative state of consciousness would be. Which reminds me of an incident in California. In the early days when we were just getting meditation established in this country, a lot of researchers hopped on this and wanted to do research. And one of the earliest forms of research they did was use EEGs. So they invited some of us down to, I don't even remember anymore where it was. Probably a hospital somewhere in California. And they had this big overstuffed chair and they had the EEG leads ready to hook up. And with earphones on. And what I remember is the guy in the control booth giving me a couple of minutes, and then this very peremptory order. He said, "Now enter the meditative state of consciousness." And of course, the needles didn't move very much. Even trying to quiet our mind usually involves some element of control and manipulation. It's not that quieting our mind is wrong, it's the way we go about it. We're trying to get to a place where we won't be hurt anymore. That's often a motive in practice. Or where we won't be ashamed of ourselves. All of that examples of spiritual bypassing. by trying to do an end run on what's actually in front of us. This is actually why some traditions and some teachers don't emphasize meditation so much, because they see it as just another attempt at control, attempt to control our minds. And from this point of view, most meditation techniques really are efforts at control. I remember sitting every morning at the basement of the Zen temple in Bodh Gaya for a long time, and the head monk of the Japanese temple there was a monk named Shibu-san. And what I remember him talking about one night was, as a young man at the University of Tokyo, how he had gone into deep mountains to learn meditation. He said, I go into deep mountains to learn meditation. Without perfect posture, not possible to learn meditation. I go back to Tokyo, I learn perfect posture. Now it is possible to sit in deep mountains. And we had a lot of Australian guys there at that time. I don't know why. Actually, men and women. And they would sit in the temple really schlumpy. And it would drive Shibu-san nuts. So he would get up in the middle of the evening service, and he would walk around in the back of these guys, and he'd grab them by the neck and the back, and he'd go, to try to get them to sit up. So for him, perfect posture was essential. On the other hand, the other end of the spectrum is someone like Adyashanti. There's a wonderful interview with Tony Simon, I think, the head of Sounds True, where she asked him about this whole question about, well, aren't you worried that your students don't really sit up straight? They're kind of slumped over. He said, no, not at all. She said, but haven't we been taught that in Zen? It opens the yoga channels, and if the yoga channels aren't open, then mine's not going to open. And he said, look, awakening happens in every posture. It has nothing to do with posture. And in fact, my teacher in Bodh Gaya was enlightened, or had his first enlightenment experience, flat on his back. He'd been taking a nap. So, without realizing it, that attempt to control our minds, our experience, creeps in. Instead, I would suggest letting that idea be the basis, the basic attitude of our practice, letting everything be just as it is. And how do we do that? Well, Dharma has a triple A for those of us who are walking the path. It's actually a triple A you can take out that helps us to let things be. It's also three A's. The first is to acknowledge what's there. The second, which is a little bit harder, which is to appreciate what's there. And the third, which is harder yet, is to accept what's there. So to acknowledge, to appreciate, and accept. And at the same time, resisting any attempts to fix ourselves or fix it. We're all such a bunch of fixers. We want to make everything right, including ourselves or our mind. So acknowledge, appreciate, accept, and then watch our mind's efforts at control and manipulation. That's a whole practice in itself. Just watching how we do that, becoming more and more familiar. And when we detect it, we let go of that control. So that's the first line of inquiry. What happens when we let things be as they are? What happens when we let things be as they are? I think our fantasy often is that, oh my God, if I let my mind just be as it is, it's kind of an untamable beast, and it's going to spin out of control, and my thoughts will carry me away. There's so little trust often in our basic nature. So things will spin out of control and we'll all be lost. In actuality, trying to control our minds is like trying to herd cats. If you give cats a big enough barn to play in, right, each one will find its own niche. They'll settle down after a while. They'll find a niche and they'll learn how to coexist. It's like letting my wife and I volunteered out at Best Friends Animal Sanctuary 2 years ago. We spent a couple of weeks there working with the animals. It's a wonderful, wonderful place that I recommend to you if you ever get a chance. It's probably the largest animal sanctuary in America, but also the one with an incredible spirit. And I was working with the horses. My wife was working with the dogs, but they took us on a tour of the cat house. That's what they called it, the cat house. It's great. And there were 600 cats in there. 600 cats. And what was immediately apparent was each one had its niche. And they did not trespass over each other's niches. And that's what will happen if we trust ourselves. Maybe at first we stop the efforts at control and things get a little bit, feel a bit out of control for a while. But they will settle down just like those cats finding a niche. Or it's like letting a dog off the leash. What happens when you let your dog off the leash? God, I let mine off the leash yesterday. He ran around this neighbor's property barking at the top of his lungs like he was chasing something. He wasn't chasing anything. I don't know what he was doing. If I thought he was having a seizure. But what happens? Eventually the dog will come back to you. It wants to come back and settle down and be near you. Horse will do the same thing. Our minds will do the same thing if we trust them. Well, it can be disconcerting at first. And it can sometimes feel like my normal sense of myself is slipping away. But that's because my normal sense of myself is so based on control, on efforts at control. And it's true also that since it's the nature of our entire being to awaken, that's actually a very powerful thought, that if you repeat that to yourself every day, several times a day maybe, it's the nature of my entire being to awaken. It is my nature to awaken. It's not my nature to screw up. My nature to awaken. Because we allow everything to be as it is in its own way, then yes, sometimes material will press up to the surface. Sometimes a lot of unconscious material gets, repressed material gets access to awareness. But we can be with that too, not all at once, but step by step. That too needs witnessing and acceptance. Although in that case, maybe some assistance from a teacher or a senior student or an experienced student would help. Because the idea, of course, is not to get overwhelmed. That doesn't help us or help anyone. So we get help for that. But that issue apart, if you really acknowledge and accept everything just as it is, you're constantly expanding the boundary around the self and holding everything in awareness so that anything that comes up, anything and everything that comes up is no longer, you can't make that distinction between self and not self. This is me, this is not me. It's all me. And that little narrow separate self begins to grow and grow and expand until there are no limits. That's even doing this foundational practice, even before insight practice. Choco Beck was a Zen teacher in San Diego, study with Maizumi Roshi. She used to call it learning your ABCs, or building your ABCs. You know what her ABCs were? It's in one of her books, Everyday Zen. She said, ABCs are a bigger container. Build a bigger container. When you come up against the limits of what you think you can tolerate, or you think you can pay attention to, or you think you can be with, make the container even bigger. And hold that in the container. So in the end, there's nothing that's outside the container. Nothing that's outside our awareness, or our love, or our compassion, or our kindness. Okay, but letting things be as they are, as foundational a practice as that is usually not enough for awakening. It's enough for a lot of things, but it's usually not enough for awakening. If we just sit and watch our thoughts and our feelings, our sensations as they come and go, practice can become pretty dry, even boring, and sometimes deadening. Probably all have found that at some point or another. It's one reason practice can become stale and lose that sense of aliveness. And what brings that back? What keeps the practice from getting stale? I think it's just this factor of inquiry. Mobilizing the energy of our natural curiosity, the energy of our spiritual yearning, can keep practice alive. Bring it alive and keep it alive. Curiosity, or inquiry, but let's say curiosity here, I've found over the years is an antidote to just about anything. If you can mobilize some curiosity in a situation about a person, about the situation itself, about your own self, a lot of stuff falls away. You can just be curious about something. It brings a tremendous sense of aliveness. And it's one of those things that ends grasping, that stops grasping. It's hard to be curious and grasping at the same time. So suppose instead of just passively observing mental and physical states as they come and go, you took a step back and you asked, who is it that's observing? Who is it that's observing? When you ask that question, you ask it and then stop. It can just provide a kind of jolt, because it turns the whole, your whole experience on its head at that moment. It redirects your attention from the object of awareness to the source of awareness, to what is ultimately true about me. But you can ask that about anything. You know, I find myself getting irritated. And who is it that's getting irritated? And really look, give yourself a moment to look and see, who is this who? Or you're tossing and turning in bed and you're insomniac and can't get to sleep. Who is it that can't get to sleep? See how you can take that question and ask it of anything. There's always a who there. Or there's an apparent who there. Those are spiritually powerful questions. They're very deep acts of inquiry. A spiritually powerful question has three characteristics. It cuts through our past conditioning to touch our essential nature. It's a question that has energy for me, energy for us. And thirdly, it's a question that always points us back to ourselves to discover who and what we really are. And any one of those questions can be that spiritually powerful question, a source of inquiry. Ultimately, of course, it's who am I or what am I? But it doesn't have to be that question. It can be something else. It's important to know how to put such a question, because it isn't like asking for directions. It isn't like asking for information. It's using the mind to put the question, but once you've asked it, not staying in the mind, if that makes sense. Using the mind to ask the question, but once you've asked it, not staying in the mind. So, because the mind will right away try to figure out an answer to the question, and that has no power whatsoever. The only power is if something shifts in here. So take that question. Who's observing? Put the question and be still. Put the question and be still. Put the question and be still. And in that stillness, eventually something will come that is unexpected and unanticipated and unimaginable. Something the mind cannot possibly know. Be still means to listen with your whole being. Be still also means holding your attention at the boundary of the known, the boundary of what you know. Take you right up to the boundary of what you know and stop and listen. And that listening is very, very deep and very profound. It's not up here. It's listening with your whole being. Adyashanti has a nice way of putting that. He says that this process of inquiry and investigation takes place from the neck down. That's where we feel it, from the neck down. So like a Zen koan, we don't try to figure the question like this out, even if we think we know the answer. All we really need to do is inquire with energy and sincerity. We really have to want to know. It's not an exercise. It's not a technique. Now, if one of these who is questions, who is observing, who is not sleeping, if they don't inspire you or they don't have an effect, there are other kinds of questions that lead up to that. you can ask, this is one of my favorites, you can ask, what do I want? What do I want? And be still. Now, that's an interesting one. It's a good one for Buddhists because we're not supposed to want anything. But this kind of wanting is a different kind of wanting. What do I want? And be honest about it. And what may come up is, what I want is a good meal tonight. Or I want to get the flat tire in my car fixed. I mean, it's amazing what comes up. You know that. But if you keep asking that question, what do I want? What do I really want? What do I really, really want? It keeps taking you deeper and deeper and deeper. It may take you through some highways and byways, and some strange stuff may come up. You may go deep, and then something ridiculous comes to mind. You go deep again. But ultimately, it goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. What do I want? Or another question you can ask is, as one thing, well, this is not just on the cushion, can be, should be all the time. As different things come through that screen of awareness, you can ask, does this satisfy me? Am I happy with this? You know the story of Faust and Mephistopheles, where Mephistopheles wants Faust's soul. And Faust says, all right, I'll make a bargain with you. You can have my soul if you can bring one thing to me such that I will say, stay thou moment thou art so fair. So Mephistopheles brings out everything that he can think of. It's kind of like Mara and the Buddha, the night of the Buddha's enlightenment. Mara trots out everything that he can think of to deflect the Buddha off his path. So Mephistopheles brings every experience that Faust could possibly think of. And each one Faust tastes and groks it. And each one he has to say, no, this is not it. This is not it. This is not it. This is not it. And we can do that in our practice as these different things come across our awareness. Does this satisfy? Does this really satisfy? And that question can go deeper and deeper and deeper, looking for what ultimately satisfies. And yet another deep question that can lead to awakening is, what do I really know for certain? You really think about that. You really are honest with yourself. What do I really know for certain? Again, Adyashanti is an interesting teacher here. He gave up meditating. Well, no, that isn't quite right. He continued to meditate, but he said meditation was the reason he failed at Zen. He said, because he said on the cushion he went to war with his mind. And so meditation didn't work for him. What he found worked was quite spontaneous. After work each day, he would go into a coffee shop and he'd take out a pencil and pad of paper. And he would take some question that had energy for him on that particular day, and he would start writing everything that he thought he knew about it. And he would not write anything that was speculative. It was only what he could say he really knew. And when he came to the end of what he knew, he would stop. Sometimes it would be right in the middle of a sentence. And he would wait. Sometimes he'd wait 2 hours, 3 hours, with a pen poised there, until something else came. But he would refuse to write anything that he didn't know for sure. And that kind of inquiry was actually what led to his awakening. He's got several accounts of that. But it was inquiry that led him there. It wasn't regular meditation practice. That didn't work for him. So, what powers this inquiry? What gives it energy for us? Well, another bad Buddhist word. I think what gives it energy for us is desire. Now, the Second Noble Truth tells us that desire is the source of all suffering. But actually, it's not quite accurate. Without a certain kind of desire, we wouldn't even set out on the path, let alone stick to it. I'll tell this in one of my favorite books. He's not a Buddhist. He's a Vedanta yogi, Nisargadatta Maharaj. I've had this on my night table, I think, for 40 years. Pretty well used. Because of all of the texts I'm familiar with, this is the one that comes closest to really describing what being awake means. Anyway, let me share this one. The whole book is Q&A, right, with students. And one student comes to him and is complaining about how he's led astray by desire. And the Nisargadatta says to him, no, he says, that's not the problem. The problem is not desire. The problem is that your desires are too small. You're not longing or yearning for the right thing. So this is another Q&A with a statement, with a student. And the student says, while in theory I'm ready to pay any price, in actual life, again and again, I'm being prompted to behave in ways which come in between me and reality. Desire carries me away. Desire carries me away. And what does Nisargadatta say? He says, increase and widen your desires until nothing is left, till nothing but reality can fulfill them. It is not desire that is wrong, but its narrowness and smallness. Desire is devotion. By all means, be devoted to the real, the infinite, the eternal heart of being. Transform desire into love. All you want is to be happy. All your desires, whatever they may be, are expressions of your longing for happiness. Basically, you wish yourself well. It's a very different way of thinking about desire. But there's something else about this kind of desire that's so essential. It's not something we generate or that we create. I'll say more about that in a minute in ending. It's something that we find, we discover, we tap into. It's like a great current that runs through life that we don't make. We cannot create. We can only find. There is that in us which is always longing to come home. That's what we tap into. That in us which longs to come home. This is the end of a poem by Kabir, who was a great 16th century saint. He was born in a Muslim family, but he practiced and taught across traditions, which occasionally got him into a lot of trouble, but he was such a great saint that they left him on the streets. This poem is called The Time Before Death, but it's just the very last stanza that I want to share with you. Kabir says this, when the guest is with a capital G, you can, guest can be God, guest can be our Buddha nature, guest can be ourselves and our deepest being. Kabir says this, when the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Isn't that wonderful? It's the intensity of the longing that does all the work. We don't have to do much work. It's the intensity of the longing that does the work. Look at me and you will see a slave of that intensity. So again, call it desire, call it longing. It's the nature of our minds, the nature of our whole being to awaken. And that carries us. It's not me or mine, not a personal possession, but that great current that runs through all of life. One last vignette. Back in the 1920s, I think, a man named T. Allen Boone, who was a Hollywood scriptwriter, was given the care of this great dog, a German shepherd, whom they had brought over from Germany. He had been trained as a war dog and a police dog, but he became the great star in Hollywood. He out-earned all of the stars in Hollywood. He was the biggest box office attraction they had. This is before Rin Tin Tin, before Lassie and all that, all the other dogs. And Boone knew nothing about dogs. So he made it, this dog was given to him by its owner to look after while the owner went abroad. So he spent months trying to get to know the dog. Made it a special mission to get to know this dog. And it's a wonderful account in a little book that's just been reissued called Kinship with All Life. It's a remarkable little book. Blow your mind. Because it's not only about dogs, it's about insects and spiders and a lot of animals that we don't like. But anyway, what he finally took to doing was following Strongheart. Strongheart was the name of the dog. Following Strongheart around with a paper and pencil, and every time he thought he saw another outstanding quality of this dog, he'd write it down. Until finally he had a list of about 100 qualities. And then the light dawned. And he said, I realized that this was not a dog with great qualities. This was great qualities manifesting as a dog. That's a turning it on its head. And of course, it's also great qualities manifesting as you and me. It's not that we have to make ourselves great, or we have to cultivate all of these virtues. All of those virtues are there already. It's like shining a white light through a prism and the light separating into all the colors of the rainbow. We didn't make that. It's all they're inherent in the light. And we can practice from that perspective and inquire from that perspective. So, Dogen Zenji, who is the great Zen teacher that brought Soto Zen from China to Japan in the 12th century, what he used to say over and over again, and I'll leave you with this, we'll end. Great questioning, great enlightenment. Little questioning, little enlightenment. No questioning, no enlightenment. So whatever our practice is, inquiry should be a part of it, needs to be a part of it. And it will take us as far as we need to go, take us home. Okay, thank you. I am open for questions, comments, reflections.